everyone's like first day of Y Combinator, they're like, best day ever, this is great. But literally that was when Apple launched ARKit. All of Tim Cook's demos look like your demos, and then your small engineering team all looks over to the two co-founders and we're like, okay, what does this mean for us? And we were like, give us a minute and we're gonna go out for a walk and discuss things. Lesson I keep learning over and over is no one cares about tech, they care about solutions. So tech is always two steps away from a customer. And then the customer said, hey, they'll buy the $1,000 pair of glasses if you can just record data. And we're like, well, you can do that for like 50 bucks of hardware. And then they're like, really? And then that was when like things started to take off. So then once we transitioned, this was over a year ago now, to wearable smart badges on retail associates.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the All Things XR podcast. In today's episode, I have Ross Finman, ex-CEO of XR Reality, which got acquired by Niantic, and current CEO of Okmoto. Hi, Ross.
Hi, pleasure to meet you.
Thanks very much, Ross, for accepting my invitation for the podcast. So, Ross, everyone who has been active in the AR and VR space, I'm sure they know you, but for those of our listeners who don't, can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background?
Sure. So my background, I come from the computer vision 3D mapping space, actually in robotics to start. So did my undergrad at Carnegie Mellon. Did my graduate work at MIT. I'm working on SLAM and 3D mapping for robotic applications. At that time, looked into the augmented reality world and was like, hey, this is a little bit easier. So rather than a robot trying to understand the world, you can have a computer understand it for AR. The idea at that point was a robot needs 99.999% accuracy, while AR is a little bit of an easier problem. Spun a company out of MIT with a co-founder from Carnegie Mellon before, doing computer vision mapping for augmented reality. We were doing the AR cloud, if you remember that buzzword before, then it became real world metaverse, and then now it's spatial AI. Anyway, essentially 3D mapping for augmented reality. Did the whole Y Combinator Silicon Valley venture capital game and very, very quickly sold that to Niantic. The makers of Pokemon Go, and we were their founding augmented reality acquisition. So we helped build up the team. There's many more acquisitions we did after that. Founded the AR mapping team, which we had the largest crowdsourced map in the world. So doing visual positioning system for applications like real-time multiplayer, large-scale persistence, large-scale kind of experiences that you can have on there. And then built up a lot of stuff at Niantic over the course of a little over 4 years. And then left there and then can't get out of the startup space. And this was during the baby formula shortage about 2.5 years ago. And as a new father at the time, I got into the retail space because I was like frustrated why retailers didn't know what products were on the shelf. I got into Okmoto, which we can cover later.
Awesome. Awesome. So Russ, what inspired you to pursue PhD in robotics at MIT?
So a lot of my friends in undergrad, like I did a lot of research projects and working at Carnegie Mellon with a lot of people in the Robotics Institute. And it was just kind of my social network was all a bunch of PhD students. And they called me as the undergrad, the head minion. So all the undergrads were minions, but they were the ones that they would say, hey, Ross, go and fix all these different things. So I ended up just spending like most of my time just working with the PhD students. And then naturally was like, hey, want to become a professor? I really love teaching. I still do. And thought that professorship path was really good. So that's what led me to go down the path of academia. And then during my time there, then was like, hey, maybe academia isn't the right path for me. So anyway, and then that did a little bit of soul searching and then wanted to go down the path of entrepreneurship from there and really loved that and went down that path.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So Russ, can you share a bit about your experience on co-founding XR Reality and getting into the Y Combinator?
Yeah, so the early days, my co-founder Diana and I, we knew we wanted to do a startup together. So we were actually going through different ideas from our backgrounds. And then this was, again, before Pokemon Go got launched. This is when Magic Leap was just like starting to create a lot of buzz back in early 2016. And then we looked at, hey, like rather than buying fancy HoloLenses and everything else, could you do stuff on mobile augmented reality? So we're really like two tech founders like saying, "Oh, we're going to make this tech and everyone's going to love it." It took a year of getting slapped around by the market a little bit to get onto a better business direction rather than just a tech direction. But really, the initial idea is what became ARKit and AR Core, launched by, of course, Apple and Google. But we were working on that in early 2016. And then the key problem that we kept running into was, okay, you'd run out of memory and space if you're trying to do mapping on a device. So then said that, hey, you need to do most of the mapping on the cloud. And then that's what ended up, and this was about a year before the AR cloud buzzword was born. So then that became the, hey, let's solve the front end problem today. And we were still trying to find who was the right customer on that. We were talking to different marketing people, people in education. Gamers were, especially after Pokemon Go launched, then that just drew a huge rush of interest in the space. So that was where we ended up finding like a whole list of different game developers that wanted to sign up to work with us. So that was like kind of the hint of product market fit in a way. I'd say it was a little bit more hype market fit at the time, since we were still a little bit early on. But yeah, then once we got like the initial demo of systems, we were starting to work with different game developers, applied to Y Combinator, got in, and then that led into an interesting first day of experience. So everyone's like first day of Y Combinator, they're like, best day ever, this is great. But literally that was when Apple launched ARKit. So when like you're
I
all
remember
moved
back
into so
then.
you all like literally day one. So it was just like, oh yeah, tonight's gonna be the whole orientation for Y Combinator. And at 10:30 in the morning, you're all watching the WWDC, and then when all of Tim Cook's demos look like your demos, then your small engineering team all looks over to the two co-founders and we're like, okay, what does this mean for us? And we were like, give us a minute and we're gonna go out for a walk and discuss things, and end up walking for 3 hours, getting horribly sunburnt, and we're like, and then later that day went into Y Combinator as the two most dejected founders, being like, Apple just crushed us, and the YC partners were trying to cheer us up a little bit. It ended up being really good for us because, again, it doesn't feel that way in the moment, but like when you're like, okay, Apple just crushed us, but fundamentally our business was on the cloud, which we'd actually had been working on. We just need to accelerate that time frame. So then things started to move really, really fast at that point. And then things took off a lot from there.
Awesome. My guest two episodes ago was Matt Meisnick, and his startup 60AI got also acquired by Niantic. Did you two had any collaborations at Niantic?
Yeah, so we overlapped a little bit, chatted. I was at that point, that was about 2 years after our acquisition. So we got a lot of the initial mapping and SDK work kind of set up at that point. So I was working on some of the longer term strategic projects with John Hinckley, the CEO at that point. So yeah, we overlapped, I think, very highly of him. Like Matt, he was the one who literally birthed the AR cloud buzzword. Like that was. I learned a lot about kind of marketing and moving market dynamics actually from him on the outside. So I have a lot of respect for, because like for us, we were trying to pitch the back end of AR. That was our kind of venture capital tagline. This was like a few weeks before he did his AR cloud buzzword or AR cloud introduction blog post. And some of the venture capitalists would ask us, they're like, the back end of AR? Is that the butt of AR? And you're like, really? So when AR cloud buzzword, we're like, ah, oh, yeah, that one's going to work a
That's
lot
it.
better. So once he helped build up a lot of the momentum and interest in the space, and then Niantic, when they were going through and talking to many companies, we were the ones that had a lot of the, like, we were happy to demo the tech, show it, and we've been working on it for quite a while already. So then that was a good. Or it was a good match because they were also like over 90% of the market that we were going into. And I still remember it. John Hankey and I went out to dinner, and he said, he's like, I want to map the world again. And it's like, what a boss. It was a very no, they like, because they were the former Google Maps, Google Earth, Google Street View team, and they were also the leaders in augmented reality. And our vision at Escher Reality was to build the map of the world, and they were literally the only people, or some of the only people, that had actually like built the map of the world before. Except now we were doing it for a finer grain version, also kind of starting with Earth as an AR game board. So from chatting with some of the initial people, like John, another guy, Michael, just felt it was a very good fit for us. Initially, we weren't, like this was, all these conversations were happening literally like weeks after our fundraise. So it wasn't, we weren't planning on getting acquired, but just feel like the fit and the opportunity there was just spectacular. And a lot of the stuff that Niantic's done now and grown, like they were aligned. There were some, like with any acquisition, some bumps along the way, but at least as long as everything is aligned towards the same North Star, then a lot of things can move forward well.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So, Russ, how Azure Reality's technology contribute to Niantic's AR platform right now, which is known as Lightship?
So it was really, we were the first ones to have any SDK. So kind of think of us as like the seed. Like there's a lot of acquisitions that kind of fleshed out the platform from there. So the initial like multiplayer experiences that was based off of the initial tech that we were doing, the initial persistence of like, hey, you can leave a Pikachu on a bench for like different photos. And the big thing was, how do you platformize like kind of an early stage startup stuff into something that can handle the scale of Niantic when you have tens of millions of Pokemon Go, Ingress, Harry Potter, and other players. Then that was a, let's just say, a very strong lesson learned. Like as a startup, you can kind of chip away at a problem. And then when you get into a company the size of Niantic, which was relatively small when we joined, like 120 people, and it was over 1,000 when I left. So got to see a lot of that growth. But like when you have a very massive product that people want to use on there, the robustness that you need is a little bit different from, hey, six people and a startup in a townhouse in Sunnyvale, to something that needs to work across the globe. So learned a heck of a lot during that process.
Awesome. So Russ, can you share a bit about your lessons and experiences from the acquisition of Azure Reality by Niantic? What would you change about your negotiations, your decisions about this subject?
Well, can't go into too much of the details of any of the negotiation stuff. All I would say is, while it didn't feel like it at the time, Niantic was actually a pretty nice acquirer. They were still figuring it out, but also I was like 27, 28 years old, and it was literally the first business deal of my life. So I was trying to navigate that. I would say I won't talk through any of the deal terms, but at least from an emotional perspective, very, very challenging. And like the emotional highs and lows are very, and they're very extreme on there. So like for months, I actually, as I was going through it, didn't sleep more than like 4 hours a night, not because I didn't have the time. It was just, I'd wake up from like nightmares, and then you'd be like, oh, okay, what about this thing and that term, everything else? And are they playing games on this? Because there's a little bit of a, like you are two people across the table from each other. And then when you get to the other side, you realize, oh, actually, they were actually trying to be nice on most of the stuff. And there's a lot of, you hallucinate a lot of kind of bad things during the process on there, which, like Niantic, they were very good people. I'd say for anyone going through an acquisition, like try and get in as much information as possible, but from as many different sources, but also recognize that everyone comes from their own incentive structure, like venture capitalists. The moment that you get to a, hey, the pie is fixed, any of them then can shift into, oh, well, how big is my pie? So rather than everyone being aligned on growth, when it comes down to like, here's the things that go to the employees, the founders, retention versus what goes to the cap table. So incentives aren't aligned at that point. So someone who, and we had great investors and everything else, but it was kind of, you could tell like some of the stuff in there, like you could be pushed in a certain direction. And then also just managing the loneliness of it all. So then if you're like, your employees are, hey, we're trying to build the product. Like, why we don't see you? You're just, quote, going out to lunch all the time. But like, you're doing what is best for the company at that point. And from their perspective, it makes sense. But from a founder's perspective, that can be a little bit hard to balance. How do you navigate conversations like with your kind of co-founder at that point? Because again, everything's moving very quickly. So then there's a lot of just trust in terms of, hey, you handle this, I handle that. I'm balancing that out. And then at the time, my girlfriend had just moved literally cross country, literally when we're like negotiating term sheets. And she's like, hey, can we go on a date once? And then please. And you're just like, I can't, like, so it's, and then just the realizing that, like, from an external standpoint, everything looks all great and rosy. During it all feels like kind of you're one conversation away from like a lot of stuff going down. And I would say majority of that was probably just my inexperience, having gone through it. But fundamentally, like, here's a course on how to do an acquisition. And if any one of your listeners is going through that, like, I'm happy to be a sounding board and kind of help out in that, because it's
Awesome.
now I've been on the acquired side, I've been on the making acquisitions side, and then now going through it'll be okay, this is the way things work, and it becomes a lot easier. Oh, and then you realize that, lawyers, they're billable hours. Everyone makes that joke, but when you get into an acquisition stuff, it, hey, every question, and they bring on five people onto the call. Like, I just for fun thought it would be a kind of fun thing to do to add on a box of cookies as part of the deal. And then for anyone who knows me, they know my cookie story, and I probably had the world's most expensive cookies from all the legal discussions that went over in terms of like how to tax them and everything else. I figure that detail in the negotiations isn't too controversial.
Awesome. Russ, you've been on the other side of the table as well. Do you have any interesting story or any suggestions about in the same negotiation and the same situation?
So for people, this is general advice that I think goes even beyond just Niantic. Like, I talked to a lot of friends who also do a lot of acquisitions in big tech on there. Finding out who is your champion and like who's the one internally that is going to go to bat for you in the meetings in there, because regardless of the company, there's always an internal meeting of, hey, here's the opportunity and like what do we think about it, and you need to make sure your champion is, I like, fist on the table, I want this company. And if you don't have that, if it's kind of a, yeah, I would like to keep a good relationship, keep me updated on there, then from a startup perspective, you can feel a sense of urgency of, I need to do a deal now, where like I'm running out of money in 2 months, and then like there's that pressure. But if there's not the same pressure on, or the same excitement on the other side, then like answering the question of why now and who can drive the why now. So like in any major company, you'll do like a build versus buy. So then there has to be a, oh, okay, if I don't acquire this now, then in 6 months, a competitor will move a lot faster. Therefore, like it may take me 18 months to try and build out this capability with a certain level of risk. But then, or is it worth that saving that 18 months by writing a bigger check today with a certain level of acquisition risk to balance that out? So just making sure you understand who is the champion, like, how excited are they about it, and what is the why now that is driving the decision? Because like I was in some conversations that like, hey, there'd be no difference between now and 6 months from now, and if that's the case, then you're probably not going to get a deal done. So anyway, there's a lot of nuances in there, but those would be the high level takeaways.
Awesome. So, Ross, my last question about Niantic. How do you see Niantic's role in shaping the future of AR gaming and applications? Because when I talk to my guests on the podcast and all around AR space, though Pokemon Go is a huge success and known for the most successful AR app in history, many people don't consider it as an AR app.
So I would say, like, Pokemon Go, not necessarily AR in terms of, okay, are you trying to build up a visual inertial odometry system, getting the like timestamp alignment between the cameras and the IMU and all the different details on there. But something throughout my own career, like coming from MIT and then now going off and more being on the business side than the tech side to some degree, like, who cares? Like, like a bunch of people in the world imagine that they caught their first Pokemon in AR. That impact of, hey, there are Pokemon in the real world, when you're going to a new location, pulling out your phone and seeing that. If that's done via GPS, if that's done from a 3DOF IMU, if that's from visual inertial odometry, is that from large scale multiplayer VPS style system? Like, fundamentally, do people smile? Kind of, I view that smiles are the best KPIs for gaming. So I view one, like Niantic led the way in terms of what is the future of AR development. And bravo for doing it without like having to build like huge amounts of tech, like magically pad two and struggled with. Got something to market that people smiled, that they experienced, that they enjoyed. And who, like the bare minimum of tech that you need to do that is like the best. So like the person, David, who actually built the first AR experience for Niantic, it was initially supposed to be based off of like Street View data and everything else on there of like, hey, you could see a Pokemon relative to Street View, but that like live experience that was hacked together over a weekend. And I got to see like the first video of like catching a Pokemon in AR. And then like, and everyone who looked at that smiled internally. And that was when people knew that, hey, that's a good experience. So I'd say like, don't let the tech and I say this as someone who was previously on that, don't let tech snobs like myself before say, oh yeah, that's not AR and kind of everything else. Like fundamentally people enjoyed it. They used it. They imagined that this Pokemon in the real world. And if that fulfilled the fantasy for people, fantastic. Tech is two steps away from a customer. You need to solve the middle step. And I would say that Niantic's leadership in the space for driving that forward and showing like, hey, people don't really remember, but back before 2016, the Pokemon Go launch, everyone was like, AR? Do you mean virtual reality? Like, mm-hmm. It was all about like Oculus and headsets. And then that shifted the whole mindset. So then became a lot more interest in the space, changed the conversation. And I view that leadership and that moving forward doesn't get the same appreciation that I think it should. And then Niantic continuing to push the ball forward. And yeah, the market has gone through its highs and its lows, and then Meta rebrands and you get another high. And then I think we're coming out of a low right now. And things are getting in there, but like I've seen enough of these ups and downs throughout the market that like, okay, Niantic has been a consistent pillar in the industry during that time, pushing the tech forward. And it's amazing that they've had the kind of vision to say, here's where the future is and wanting to build that and actually executing towards it. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about John Hankey working with him.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, awesome. So, Bryce, what motivated you to start another startup like Modo after your time at Niantic?
Masochism. it was taking time off. So, I was like on paternity leave and then was thinking through kind of like when you spend 4 years at a place, always thinking about like what's next. And then again, it was I was already looking at the kind of commerce space because like if you have the map of the world, like a key thing you need to think about from a startup perspective is, hey, how do you monetize it? So which is very, very important. And for any of your listeners, like fundamentally startups, it's all about provide value or die, which is nice. Like you don't have to worry about like Q4 headcount planning meetings or internal alignment. It's like, okay, how do you provide value? Otherwise, you don't have anything. So then I was thinking about like everything that I saw at Niantic and like where the market was moving, what technologies were moving forward, and kind of tried to play that out. And I was like thinking about like the commerce market because like that's where a lot of like in the real world, that's where a lot of money is moving around. And as a startup, again, that is your proxy for value because you need to keep the lights on there. So, and then it really crystallized, like, again, during the baby formula shortage that I mentioned earlier. So, again, when you have a six-month-old kid and you, like, number one pain point, feeding them, making sure that everything's okay. And when you have, like, hey, it's a Saturday and we're running out of baby formula on Sunday, then you go on, like, the Target app and you're like, Target has baby formula, like, in stock. Great, order for curbside pickup. And you drive out there quickly in the minivan. You're like, I got it. And then, sorry, we've substituted that for skim milk. And you're like, really? That's not going to work. And then you're going like 100 miles in a minivan going like store to store, just searching for food for your kid. Then you end up like, I got just really frustrated with why don't these retailers know what's on the shelf? And then was like, okay, hey, that's a computer vision mapping problem. Mm-hmm. So then initially got in the space, and again, with my, I was a little too tech forward at the beginning, but like, oh, you could solve this with like AR glasses, you could record data with the camera, you could have a hands-free display. And it was like wonderful, or it made so much sense from a technology standpoint. And then again, from the lesson I keep learning over and over is no one cares about tech, they care about solutions. So tech is always two steps away from a customer. So then it was when we finally found like our stride when we actually built out a whole AR headset shopping experience for an e-commerce shopper. And then the customer said, hey, they'll buy the $1,000 pair of glasses if you can just record data. And we're like, well, you do that for like $50 of hardware. And then they're like, really? And then that was when like things started to take off. So then, then once we transitioned, this was over a year ago now, to wearable smart badges.
Awesome.
On retail associates. So then just, hey, they wear a dumb badge today. And if you can just have a passive wearable smart badge, you can actually build, and again, from a tech perspective, these live updating 3D maps of a store. So you think of it like a Google Street View for shelves, updated at any time an e-commerce person, a stalker, a janitor, a manager is walking around the store. So 100% passively. Then if you're able to build up that map of the store, then it's a lot easier to monetize the data for commerce than it is to monitor sidewalks, playgrounds, and fountains. So like, I like to say that spatial computing connects bits to atoms and retail connects atoms to money. And again, it's not about just the exact dollars and cents per se, but like as a startup, you need to keep the lights on everything else, then you need to provide the value to the customer in that way. And we found a lot of interest and traction and have already launched with customers that have been super excited and saw like massive, like 9 figures of improvement from like a 4 week kind of testing system. So it's, things have been moving very, very quickly. And fundamentally, I view that like commerce is going to be one of the most disrupted markets by all the spatial computing tech, because it's fundamentally like people moving goods. And if you can, again, free up their hand with future AR glasses, if you can help track a lot of the inventory, if you can add 2 years of experience to every associate, then there's so much of the technology that's getting built for wearables and spatial computing that can apply very tangibly. Like there's a lot of questions in the AI market. A few companies are making some money, but today, like a lot of other people are, they have fuzzier business models of, hey, let's do an AI chatbot for travel and we'll try and figure out a way to weave in things. And here it's like, hey, if a product is not on the shelf, they're not making money. So how do you detect if a product is not on the shelf? And that is a very constrained problem. So I'd say a high level takeaway for your listeners and people who want to get interested in space, make sure you have very tangible, concrete problems. So like for Escher Reality, it's like, if I put a Pikachu on there, I want you to be able to see the same Pikachu. Now with Ogmoto, it's like, hey, if a product's not on the shelf, you're not making money. So then, and the customer's unhappy, they're not getting their baby formula. Like retailer's unhappy, they missed out on a sale on there. Supplier's unhappy because they, so anyway, it's just having those grounded examples and not just a tech, if you build it, they will come. And I say that as someone who started off on both my companies a little bit more, especially the first one, way too much on the tech side. I thought I had enough of the lessons learned, but still like just that iteration cycle quickly with the customer and how can you feed them information?
Awesome. So Russ, the first question that comes to mind is why wearables and not just static cameras?
So two things for that. One, putting up enough static cameras in a store can be tens of thousands or $100,000 plus per store. Well, like you can have, hey, 20 employees wearing cheap smart badges, then you can scale a lot quicker because the people are going around in there. So then you can have on like one end of you just install a huge amount of sensor infrastructure, which is very costly, and you need like two shelves facing each other. So it doesn't really work for end caps, or you need to put like a boom out there to have a camera facing in. There's just a lot of nuances, even like installing wiring to power these, or you have to do a battery, which then requires replacement. Meanwhile, like your associates are already walking around with a smart badge, or you can have like robots driving through. But like anytime I see a robot going through, I don't go down the aisle. And knowing my now 3-year-old, like he'll be like, oh, a robot. And he'll like smash his like toy, a space shuttle into the robot. And I'm like, you know, that's happening. That's what I would have done as a kid. And maybe not all kids were like me, but like, So at least the ease of getting the data, and also if people are going around doing e-commerce picking, if they're stocking shelves, like you're getting within arm's reach of like all the products, most of them, like a lot of times every day. So that's kind of on one, is just comparatively, it's a much easier, simpler, scalable solution. And then the thing that I view really drives us, though, is this idea of like, how do you, instead of like replacing the workforce, how do you enhance the workforce? So rather than AI replacing jobs, we view that AI should augment them. So how do you make the employees more valuable? How do you make their lives easier? Because no one likes going around and counting every last product like on the shelf on there. That's not like an enjoyable part of the job. But it's something that has to get done. So if you can make their lives easier, and then for e-commerce pickers, if you can like direct them to the right product, then you can have the, hey, find the baby formula. Anyone who's ordered on Instacart or others, like the substitution problem, like when 5 to 10% of all products ordered, like a year ago, there was a sale on lobster, and I was like, oh, we got everything for a lobster dinner. And then we got everything but the lobster. And it was like, well, like, doesn't quite all work for chicken. So that frustration.
Awesome. So Ross, can we get a bit more technical on the AI and computer vision problems and challenges you're trying to solve in Agimoto? And how do you plan to solve them?
So we can't get into too much of the secret sauce, but just to scope out the problem for you, like stores have tens of thousands of products. So if you think about like an average grocery store is anywhere from 40,000 to 60,000 products. To get to a Walmart, you're 120,000 plus. So like, how do you keep track of like tens of thousands of products across like a 3D environment, from wearable cameras that are effectively bouncing around with every step? Like that is a very non-trivial problem. Like it's much easier if you could have it like, hey, here's cameras like going around on a nice linear path on there. So trying to think about it in terms of like, rather than, hey, how do you get one scan that's nice? How do you get 100 scans that are okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's more of a search problem. Like if you have dual 4K video feeds, how do you pull in the information and search over what is the best frame that like saw this particular product area? Maybe the product next to it is a different frame on there, but like, how do you reduce the amount of data? Kind of flipping a lot of the AI problems on their head, and that most companies are data limited. We are not data limited. There are so many physical people walking around stores all the time. So it's a question of how do you do all the reduction to work within the constraints that you can have in the store, because you don't have a dedicated fiber optic line to stream all this data back to the cloud. And even if you could, that's like a way too much for cloud compute costs in order to scale the business. So then you need to be very smart about like, how do you build the infrastructure? How do you cut down on the amount of data while still providing the end valuable experience and the data and the analytics and then solutions to the customer on there? So it's a massive, like you have hundreds of thousands of cubic feet that you're looking over for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of products, from hundreds of scans that are going around the store in an ever-changing environment. Like if you build a map at 8 a.m., like the amount of products that get sold by 8 p.m., you kind of have an almost different store. At least all the products are slightly moved. So it's a very, very challenging problem given the dynamics of the store and the dynamics of the way in which we're capturing it, which like we had to solve some or many of these problems like at Niantic before, of like, hey, someone's scanning a Pokestop, then like maybe they're scanning down, maybe they're holding it up, maybe they're like jogging as they're doing it. So like there's a lot of nuances and lessons learned from kind of past experiences, but then you also need to handle like, hey, a fountain doesn't change too much. Meanwhile, like you could sell out of Cheerios. So then if you have something that says, I see Cheerios, and like, therefore I know where I am. And then what if you don't see Cheerios like an hour later? How do you handle those types of dynamics? Because it's a very dynamic problem. It's all, but like, again, with all the people walking around the store, it's all in the data. So it's just I find it all very fascinating how it all can kind of piece together and like kind of solve for it. So it's a very, it's one of these things like we won't be bored for a while.
Yeah, exactly. We also had a project for indoor navigation for shopping malls and et cetera. And we patented the solution, did a bunch of samples for shopping malls and shopping centers. And I know it is a very, very, very difficult problem and challenge. And just knowing the relocalizations and et cetera, and especially in environments that change a lot, it's very, very hard and it's very, very challenging. And
absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not too worried about competitors going after the space, because it's like one of these things from a high level, it's like, oh, that's not too easy. But when you get into the nuances and the weeds in there, like, it's a very challenging. But the thing is, it's also, it's a very constrained problem too. Like, you don't have to deal with like, hey, what happens if shadows change, or it's a rainy day or a sunny day? Like, lighting is consistent. Like, products change, but like, it's not like all the products change every day, all the time on there. So like, when, if you're working outside, it snowed. Okay, what do you do? Nothing looks the same. So like, there's different ways, but again, that gets into, for any of your listeners looking to start a company, like, make sure, one, that your customer actually really, really cares about the problem, which in retail, this is a very clear constrained problem. But then two, you have the everything constrained. So a lot of my job is getting the 20 different things that our customers want, which again is great to have that level of engagement where they're trying to influence the product roadmap in that way. But then like, how do you balance out those sales customer needs with like the tech? And then how do you get them to stack on top of each other? Because many times a customer, if you just follow exactly what they say, in one sentence, the first half will be something, yeah, you could get that together in a month. And the second half, it'll be like, okay, 4 years of R&D effort. And then from their perspective, it's all the same, but they like, because it's all just problems from their perspective. So that's the job of an entrepreneur and the founder is to, hey, what does the customer need? How do you solve it well enough? And then go from there. And it's like a, how do you chip away at the problem? And that's a useful framework for how I think through evaluating entrepreneurship ideas, is what I call cliff problems versus gradient problems. So like a cliff problem is like self-driving cars. It works 99% of the time. It means you die one out of every 100 miles. But like, so those are very, very hard. And arguably, like, I haven't seen many companies succeed at cliff problems.
Yeah.
But if you can have like companies like Airbnb or Uber, it's like, okay, start with San Francisco, expand to New York, expand to here, and you can kind of chip away at it. And I view for every startup that I've seen that's done well, it's they've been able to elegantly balance out the enormity of like the vision that they're going after, but then being able to have a here are the chipping away in order to get in there, so that makes the customer happy along the path as you're building it. So, and it's a, and that's part of just the journey of entrepreneurship, is balancing out all the different needs, all the different constraints. You only have so much money, so much people, like so much time in order to build all this stuff. And like, but that's the multidimensional kind of game that you need to play.
Yeah, yeah, totally get that. So what are your long-term goals for Agmodo, and where do you see it in, for example, 5 years?
I get very, very excited about like the future of what commerce can be on there. So to be specific about that, like I view, you can like, you can have a spatial AI assistant for every associate. So people talk about that with like, Humane tried to go after that, had their own challenges. But like, if you can have that for like the largest physical workforce in the world, where every associate can have 2 years of experience on day one. They know where every product is, they're given information when and where they need it. So like that I view as an exciting kind of goal and where we want to get to, and how do you enable every employee? So it's not just, is a product on the shelf or not? It's how do we help people in their job, like for the largest physical workforce on the planet. And then where I get really excited in like the 5+ year horizon is changing the future of shopping. So like I view, if you want on your Apple, Google, Meta smart glasses, like if you want to have shopping as a use case, you're going to need the data of the store. So like, how do you integrate on like your Apple glasses or your Meta Ray-Bans to like navigate your shopping list? How do you have a gluten-free filter? How do you have like right now, like clipping coupons and bringing them in to save like dollars here? Like that's really annoying. what if that can be done automatically? And one of the things that really cemented that for me was when we were trying things out with the AR glasses. And then when you grab a product, and just with recognition model, just by looking at it, it dings it off your shopping list. Like every person I ever demoed that to smiled. Like that was wow. It was like a wow moment and then that was when I'm like, okay, this is going to be like the future of shopping. When you have smart glasses, can be a fundamentally better and more magical experience. It was like that kind of Steve Jobs, Apple, like wow moment that, okay, people didn't care about the tech or anything else, but there was just an emotional, positive, like smile that they got out of it. And as I talked about before from gaming, like the power of like smiles are the best KPIs. It's a little bit more in gaming than it does in the retail world, but like that if you have the data of the store to enable the workforce, you also have the data that you need for the future of consumer shopping once consumer adoption gets big enough. And I view in the 5-year horizon with like the popularity of the Meta Ray-Ban stories and like Google announcing glasses again, a bunch of other companies going after it. Like it does feel like for at least a simple heads up display, like the timing is getting pretty close on there. Where it's independent for us, like we have our own hardware, we have our own business model and everything else. But like once you're in the store, like I don't view many other big tech companies are going to do all the B2B retail integration.
Mm-hmm.
To connect all that, like is Apple going to work with every like pharmacy, big box, like grocery chain? No. So if you can, yeah, like that part of how do you change all of commerce is very interesting.
Yeah, surely. Russ, how do you see the relationship between AR and AI evolving in the coming years?
Well, it kind of gets into the definition of AR. So if you're looking for immersive AR of like what HoloLens or Magic Leap or the ones we're trying to do where, hey, I can see a Pikachu can run around on my thing. I still view that's a ways away. Like I view that can be very helpful, but like the heads up displays and like Meta has already done this with the AI assistant and the Ray-Ban glasses. Now that's entirely like there's no display in there at all. But if you could have a small display where you ask a question and then like rather than it talking to you, you could see things or show me a map of this. How could you have that? So I actually view AI or what we call spatial AI. There's kind of the pure digital AI of, hey, ask questions and you just have like an LLM. Like a Gemini or ChatGPT or Llama model, and then it answering for you in a pure digital space. Like that's all going to develop naturally. But when you get into spatial AI of what are you doing in the real world, that's where I view a lot of the opportunities start to get unlocked for augmented reality. So again, you're not going to have this full sixth off tracking multiple cameras on all the time, like 3D displays, 70 degree field of view, like the Orion devices that Meta demoed. I think I'll be surprised if that in a glasses form factor happens this decade, but you get the small heads up display systems that I view are getting good enough. That's where I view a lot of the spatial AI and what could you do with a constant on wearable camera? What are the different, or not even constant on, but like queryable camera? So like, hey, tell me what I'm looking at. Like there's simple things like, okay, can you show me directions to this? And it kind of guides you and provides visual feedback on there, which is like a little Call of Duty compass arrow. Biased, but I do think shopping is going to be a major use case of like, hey, what if that compass arrow could guide you to help you find the black lentils in a grocery store? Because I don't know where those are. So that I view the relationship of AR and AI probably in the short term is going to be in the heads up displays, in the smaller glasses, in the consumer world. And I even think to a certain degree in the B2B space as well. But like, how do you get, what are the simple, concrete things that you can do rather than here's an AI assistant to help you with every aspect of your day. Like that when you're dealing with the real world, like you've dealt with this, like even if you have, here's an AI assistant just for malls, like, okay, there's like 100+ stores just in a mall. Like these are very large areas. Like that starts to open up a lot of the problems within there. So how do you get very constrained and specific? So like an example could be, hey, tell me like given my pantry, like taking a photo of it, what could I make for dinner? And then step me through some of the processes in order to make that. Like, Okay, how did that gets rid of recipe guides, scrolling through allrecipes.com and like everything else in a very visual, more intuitive way. Not entirely sure what the business model is in that one, but that is a use case with a, hey, you can take a photo, you can do this just with an LLM, and can connect the physical and digital for something that's actually practical. Again, business side, maybe there's something there, maybe something not, but just an example off the top of my head, harder to come up with.
Awesome. So, Russ, as an entrepreneur, how do you manage your mentality, your psyche? And we all know that being an entrepreneur is a very stressful job and situation. How do you manage that? How do you manage as a parent? How do you manage your work-life balance?
I
Do you believe
mean,
in that at all?
well, let's say, like, it is a balancing act, and like some days are worse than others. And then, so like everything for an entrepreneurship, you're always just you're pushing yourself to the absolute limit, and you have to love living at the limit, like where it's every day you're not like a, oh, okay, I don't need to work today, or oh, it's Christmas vacation, no one's coming into Google for the next 2 weeks, therefore you can go in there. It's like a, okay, like how do you kind of like you have to enjoy the grind. So I'd say like for balancing the psyche on there, like, hey, when you have your down days, then I listen to some like the gym motivational music that's like fall or knock down seven, get up eight, and kind of like driving you forward. So yeah, I would say again, there's a great video from Elon Musk where he was quoting another entrepreneur, but it was if you need motivation, like doing entrepreneurship is like eating glass while staring off into the abyss. You need to like enjoy the pain in the moment while you're off in the unknown figuring it all out, and then that needs to excite you and you find the opportunities within there. So at least
Sean
for me,
Parker, I
like
think.
balancing, oh okay, maybe he was quoting Sean Parker on that. Yeah, I remember the Elon Musk clip, but I knew he was quoting someone else. Feel bad not with having the right reference, but it's a like it's a very apt quote, but also just the realizing that like enduring all the highs you end up coming back to the mean, and then enduring all the lows you end up coming back to the mean. So I've been through enough of the highs and lows of like, oh, you feel like terrible when Apple launches the same demo as you, and you're just like, are we crushed? And then like, okay, 2 months later, you do fundraising in like 10 days, just because, oh my God, there's so much interest flowing into the space. And then like, you sell a company afterwards very quickly, and then you're in a very good financial spot. You're like, I'm on top of the world. And then like 3 months later, you're like, oh my God, integration of like two companies, like this is very challenging. And then you have to deal with yeah, just the highs and lows of the different startups, and just realizing that like over the long term, it's how do you chip away at it and balance it? I would say the hardest part for me is what you brought up. How do I balance being a good dad, which is arguably more important than anything I can do on the startup side, but you also need to balance out like your own work needs and everything else. And a simple thing that I've kind of come to is happiness comes from family and fulfillment comes from work. And you need to balance the both of them. Like just spending time with family, I feel like, what am I doing? What am I building? Everything else in there. And if I try to find fulfillment through my kids, I'm probably screwing them up a little bit. But then if I haven't been successful yet in finding happiness in my work, like I find it fulfilling, but it's not like on a day-to-day basis. Like this is just like Disneyland. This is no, like it's a so then I find that the balancing of happiness and fulfillment, that's something that I'm still working on getting the right balance of, but at least articulating that both are valuable, but they're different. They both take time. But yeah, and I view my goal in life before was to like live a happy life. And now I don't actually think that is a good goal for me. Maybe it's good for other people and they're probably wiser than I am. But my goal in life is to live a life worth suffering for. So like when you get to the end of it and you're like, oh geez, that sucked. And you're like, I'd do that again. There's a certain like group of people and friends that you build up that they're just like, oh yeah, like you got a sucker punch to the face and like, but like you picked yourself up and there's a certain excitement and growth and like even talking about it and like that's kind of the spice of life that I kind of go for. And like I can look back on the past year or two or six and say, hey, I don't know really what more I could have done with the time that I had. And if every 3 months in a startup, you can look back and say, oh, like we advanced so much more. Like we were in such a better spot than we were 3 months ago. And if you can keep saying that every 3 months, then that's a really strong amount of growth. And I find that fulfilling. But yeah, it's definitely not easy. And like, there's times when you're just like, curled up in the fetal position, being like, oh, geez, like, why is this happening? And then, but you just keep pushing forward and getting it. As long as, again, everything is building on top of itself and any bad days comes up to the mean and the good days. I actually have even developed a, maybe this is getting too much in my own personal psychology, but like every time like I have a really, really good day, I actually get like paranoid. I'm like, okay, I don't know what's gonna happen. Like we just finished an amazing conference last week, and then I have like so much inbound interest, things are so positive, our current customers, things are going, and you're just like, okay, I don't know where the sucker punch is gonna come from. Like and then you're like and then it's like it's going too good for too long, like something's gotta break. And then you're just like, so it's kind of a little bit of paranoia on there, but it's also like it's constant problem solving, constant like working through what are the different solutions, getting the team of people that you're with, that you're all on the same page, and like you're not dealing with the like again the headcount planning, the performance reviews, the like alignment of internal things, all the communication challenges that you have across different teams that you can get in like large companies. And then you get that like in a small company, like you can really move fast, it's really rewarding, and it's just exciting. So I don't know. You can tell I like it.
Yeah, me too. So, Russ, do you have any book or any kind of other contents recommendations that helped you in your journey?
No, like one that's been hugely impactful. I'd say the best thing for me has just been talking with other founders and building up the relationships on there, because like just hearing the different stories when like, oh, okay, here's how other people handle these scenarios. Like, I'd say the best book that comes to mind is Ben Horowitz, The Hard Things About Hard Things. So just
The best.
like you can tell like, hey, they went through it all. Well, that's really what startups
We can
are. And then
relate
from
so
extra,
much.
yeah. And then like from an outside perspective, you're like, oh wow, you IPO'd in a tough market. You sold for like $1 billion+ in there. Amazing success. So you realize like all the roller coaster during the middle of it, and you can tell like it was a very raw book. So I'd say that's a good one for just knowing like what it goes through. But fundamentally, especially in the early days of a startup, like it's a little bit more of an art than a science. It's like the individual people that you bring on can change fundamentally the direction that one idea that someone has in there. And then like there's always the stories of like, oh, the success went, oh, if this one person hadn't brought up that, then like it wouldn't have been as big. And you're like, okay, is that success bias? But like, but you realize like, hey, the people that you have around there can shape what are the types of like what makes a good first customer might be, do they have a personal relationship with someone on your team? I don't know. I haven't been that fortunate yet, but like it's just kind of the constant problem solving. And if you just go by like, here's one book and how to do entrepreneurship, you're not adapting to the market, adapting to the nuances. Like your first customers, especially in the B2B space, they're believing in you as a founder, you as a team. And like they're investing even more so in that and saying, hey, I believe that you can get there. And that's up to you to kind of deliver on that. So I'd say the adapting to the market is better than any one book that like says, oh, and here's the stepping stones towards in there. And like, and I guess on that note, like the best, what I tell everyone that I mentor, is, and I should write a blog post on it, is the best advice I can ever give people is to learn to filter advice. So like, I mean, if you throw away everything I say, I will be almost proud. Just in the sense of like, the filter is the most important. What advice or what book or what information can apply to you? What is useful to you? And especially as you get deeper into the company, most people who give advice, they've been thinking about your business for 15 minutes in a meeting. You've probably been thinking about it for like 15 months. You know all the nuances in there. You need to make sure that you're getting, if you don't get the advice, then you might not know other perspectives to guide your own thinking. But fundamentally, it is a, with limited information and everything else, how do you guide things on the right way? And I haven't found one resource that encapsulates that. There's a lot of anecdotes. There aren't a lot of, and I don't think that there is a manual.
Yeah, totally agree. Russ, where can our listeners reach out and contact you? And I assume you hire right now.
Yeah, so you can reach out, you can look us up on our website, www.augmodo.com. If you want to learn more about what Augmodo is doing, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on there. And for any of your listeners, like we are, or we've had a lot of strong customer momentum in a sense. So like we're growing very, very fast. We're well funded. So anyone with kind of computer vision or AI experience who wants to work at a small, very fast growing startup that wants to have a very grounded AI application with a very big vision, feel free to reach out. We are very actively hiring on there. We've hired out a lot of people from cashierless checkout companies, like doing real-time computer vision in the commerce space, but like people in self-driving cars and drones, general AI systems. It's a very, once you get into the commerce space, it gets into very interesting real-world problems that are very grounded and tangible.
Awesome, awesome. Well, Russ, it was great having you on the All Things XR podcast. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thanks very much.